very much for giving me the opportunity to come here and visit. And I thought what I was going to do today is give you somewhat of an overview over what we've been doing, and then leading towards the open questions that we hope to address now that I just started in Los Angeles. I want to point out the people at Urbana that were involved in this work. Here's several students in our group, and especially some of the newest work I'm going to talk about has been done by Yang Liu, who is a student who is actually looking for a postdoc, and he did some excellent work, as you'll see. These other students, John Carpenter and Amit Mehta, they're the ones that did also some of the work there now at Sandia, and Amit Mehta went to MIT. And down here, I have listed several people who have been involved at several different stages of the work. So it started originally with Jim Sethna, and then more recently we've done, Al Middleton has been involved in some of the work I'll point out. And here are the experimentalists whose data I'm going to show. And these are people that are involved in work that's related to this. So basically, what the talk is going to be about is systems with hysteresis. You're all familiar with hysteresis. When you take a copper rod and you bend it out of shape, it's not going to snap back. It's actually going to remember that you did something to it. Now, the type of hysteresis is the kind where you don't have something like work hardening. In the copper rod, you know, if you bend it out of shape and you try to bend it back, it's actually going to be harder than the first time you did it. The types of systems we have been focusing on are systems where every time you apply a force back and forth, you always get the same response, roughly speaking. And also, with a copper rod, typically you don't notice that there's any type of crackling noise when you bend it, unless you listen really closely. But the types of systems we've been studying, they definitely have these jumps as you apply a field. So, for example, I'm thinking of magnetic systems, so magnetic hysteresis. That's a very well-known example. When you take a magnetic sample and you apply a magnetic field and you slowly raise the field so as to magnetize the sample here, then, first of all, you go through a hysteresis loop, so here's magnetization, here's applied field, but you also hear some crackling noise. So the way it's actually usually measured is as Barkhausen noise. So what you do is you wrap a search coil around your sample, and then you hook it up originally to a voltmeter. And I hope this is going to work. I'm not sure. Then you should hear something like this. Okay. You can't hear that, right? Okay. I'm sorry. With the mic. Maybe you can hear it? Okay. I don't know where this. Let me try it one more time. Because there's going to be. Anyways, so that's the type of crackling noise that you hear when you do this, and that tells you that the magnetization process is not smooth. It's actually very jerky. The reason is the system magnetizes in these avalanches. And basically not in a smooth process. And we're going to focus on this type of jerky response to a slowly changing external driving force. Now, if you instead of this, instead of hooking up to a loudspeaker, you hook it up to a voltmeter, then you see basically this very spiky response to this slowly varying driving force. And these spikes is exactly what you just heard. And they tell you that there are domains of different sizes actually flipping in the direction of the field as you raise the field. Then if you blow this up and you calculate the area under such a voltage peak, that tells you basically how big the moment is that flipped in such an avalanche. Now, in the case of Barkhausen noise, when you look now at a histogram of these moment sizes, so here I'm plotting how often you get an event of a given size, then for Barkhausen noise, you find a very broad distribution. This is on a log-log plot, so you find a power law distribution over several decades for Barkhausen noise. Now, this plot is actually taken for earthquakes, where you have the same phenomenon. So over here is plotted the earthquake size, here in terms of magnitude or here energy, versus time. And you see also this is for a year, And you see the noise actually looks quite similar to the Barkhausen noise. It's very spiky. And if you do a histogram of the earthquake sizes, magnitude is really related to the log of the total slip in an earthquake. So this is really this histogram is again a log-log plot also for earthquakes. You also find this power law distribution, which is called Gutenberg-Richter law. And there are lots of other systems with the same features. So for example, in martensites, these are these shape memory alloys that when you bend them out of shape and you throw them into hot water, they snap back into their original shape. That's what they're famous for. But also what they do is if you look at the stress strain curve, so you pull on them, they crackle. And when you look at a histogram of the jump sizes in martensites, again, you get a very broad distribution with power law scaling over a certain range. Then in superconductors, there's some nice experiments where people looked at sizes of avalanches, of vortices, as they were driving them with a slowly changing field, and they found a similar picture with this broad distribution. Then there's some very nice experiments by Bob Halleck and collaborators on liquid helium and Vadian nuclepore, which is also very similar. If you think of what they did is they had a porous material, which like a filter material, and they were filling it with liquid helium, and then they were pumping the helium out, and then they found sometimes up to 10 to the 7 pores emptying in one big avalanche because these pores were intersecting. So in a way, they had coupling between the pores. If one was emptying, then an intersecting one would also empty. And then they looked at size distributions of these avalanches and also found scaling like this. And then rupture of fibrous materials is another example, and the earthquakes. One thing that you're not going to hear this, but I might point this out, this liquid helium invading nuclepore is a lot like the sound of you know, when you have Rice Krispies and you pour milk over them. It crackles. It's the same idea because you have pores filling with liquid, with the milk in this case. And actually, we had a recording, but since it's hard to hear it, you can listen to it after if you want. But it's very similar. It sounds very similar. Now, so the way I've structured this talk is I'll start first talking about the magnets, not because we think magnets are the most interesting case in all these different systems, but mostly because they're simple, they're easy, it's easy to get good statistics from experiments, and then I want to show you how you can learn from that something about earthquakes. So I'll make the transition a little later. So I first try to explain this model for the magnets as carefully as I can, because it's unbelievably simple. And you will very quickly see how you can just transfer a lot of it to other ideas. So the magnets, basically what we were thinking of, we have spins. In the simplest case, you might just think of an easing model where you would take a lattice of spins where the spins can only point up or down. So that's a tremendous simplification, but we're interested in scaling on long length scales. So since that turns out to be universal, I forgot to say that, for the magnets, this power law here, when you take the histogram of the pulse sizes, this power law here for this size distribution is the same for lots of different materials. So it's universal, and therefore, obviously it can't depend on the microscopic details of the system. So it's okay to start with a very simple model that just mostly gets the symmetries and dimensions and things like that right, and then see if from that you can extract predictions that actually apply to real materials for these universal properties that are the same over a large class of materials. So what we looked at was the zero temperature non-equilibrium random field easing model. So you have this lattice of spins up or down the spins. And then we also know that in these systems there is disorder. So we have to add something that models the disorder. So we took a Gaussian distribution of random fields in this case, where at each side of the lattice we add a random magnetic field and keep it quenched. What that means is we put it down, and then those are supposed to be these green arrows here. Those are random magnetic fields. They're uncorrelated in this case, and they are frozen in, and they won't change throughout the whole simulation. They're supposed to model some disorder in the system. And I'll say something later about other types of disorder and what that does. And then we studied this. Now, this model has been studied a lot in equilibrium. We're interested in hysteretic systems. Now, hysteresis tells you the system is not in equilibrium. So we study the system far from thermal equilibrium. And what we do is we say each spin is always aligned with the direction of the local field or local force, if you like. That's the rule. So what we say is we start with a very negative field. We now want to sweep the field up and back down and see if we get hysteresis. And we just use this rule. So we start with a very negative field, and when the external field is very negative, the external field is this H here. When that's very negative, then this local field will, for each spin, will be negative. If you just make it this H negative enough, it'll just be bigger than any of this. So that means all the spins are going to be pointing down, and you have a magnetization of minus one. And then as you increase the field, because you have this Gaussian distribution of random fields, some spins will have a very positive magnetic field. So, for example, this spin here has a very positive one. So this may flip before any of the other spins decide to flip. So when this local field for the spin goes through zero, then the spin flips. And then what we do is we check if any of the neighbors are now being triggered to flip also due to this ferromagnetic interaction that we have with the nearest neighbors. So if one is up, then the others also get a positive field. And then we check, do they want to flip? If they flip, we flip them as well. And then we check their neighbors and so on. And so you can get an avalanche of spin flips, which corresponds to a little jump in the magnetization curve. Okay, so that's the whole idea of the model. And if there are questions on this model, you know, interrupt me or anything. The idea is very simple. What we're basically going to do then, we're going to study the competition between the disorder in the system that tends to keep the avalanches small because it gives you a big variation in the system, and the coupling between the spins, which tends to make the avalanches grow very big. So, for example, if you have a pure system, that would be the case where this distribution of random fields is very narrow, like a delta function. In that case, your hysteresis loop would be rectangular. You basically would have no spins flipping until your external field overcomes the interaction with the neighbors, and then everybody goes in one big avalanche. On the other hand, if it's very disordered, then you get a very smooth loop, and I'll show you in a second. But I just want to make one comment. We study right now this, as a first step, the system at zero temperature, because we're interested in systems where the equilibration time scale is large compared to experimental time scales. So for magnetic tapes, for example, they're designed not to equilibrate at room temperature, right? So this should be, for these magnetic systems, be a good approximation. We also have some results on adding finite temperature, but right now I won't. If you're interested, you can ask me later, but right now we'll just stick with a zero temperature to make it more clear. Okay. So when you then sweep up the field, you indeed follow one branch of the loop, and if you sweep it back, you follow a different branch, and so you get hysteresis in your system. Now, I was already telling you what we're now going to vary is the width of this distribution of random fields, and that's what we call the disorder. So we now want to study the shape of this loop and also the noise, these avalanches, as a function of the width of this distribution of random fields. I already mentioned that for a very clean system, where your distribution of random fields is very narrow, you get a very rectangular-looking hysteresis loop. And just this one huge avalanche here, which basically sweeps through the entire system. On the other hand, for a very disordered system, you get a very smooth loop. The reason being that your random fields vary very strongly from side to side. So if one spin flips, the probability that it'll trigger another one is not too high. Because the local field varies so much. And so therefore, these avalanches don't grow very big, and that means the local slope in the loop can't be very steep, because most of these jumps are very small. So you really have to raise your field a lot to drive it from negative magnetization to positive magnetization. And between these two regimes, there's a critical disorder where you actually get scaling. So it can't quite decide, does it have a system-spanning event or doesn't it? So then it produces actually avalanches of all sizes. And that's where we have a second order phase transition. So the way you test this is here is again the histogram of these avalanche sizes. So what we did is we looked at these step sizes and made a histogram. Again, here is the number. How often do we get an avalanche as a function of the size on a log-log plot? The size is just the number of spins flipping in an avalanche. And then you notice R is the width of this distribution here. It really should be R over the coupling strength, which we said 1. But there is a critical disorder where you get scaling over here. We have like 5 decades. It's just limited by the system size. And as you go to disorders or widths of this which are higher than the critical disorder, you develop a cutoff. So the range of your scaling shrinks. You get less scaling, just reflecting a finite correlation length. So at the critical point, you have an infinite correlation length that gives you avalanches of all sizes for this case. And as you go to systems with higher disorder, you develop this cutoff because you have a finite correlation length. And then there are these nice ways of collapsing all this data. If you stretch these axes, you can collapse them all onto one curve. This is this Widom scaling argument. Basically, near a phase transition, if you're able to collapse them, rescale the axis such that they do collapse onto one curve. And by the amount that you have to rescale the axes, you can read off what these universal exponents are. So, for example, in this case, this should really be S, the size to the minus tau plus sigma beta delta. This is just historical reason for this name. But basically, this exponent is the power law that you see here. And from this procedure, you find it's 2.03. So this would be a universal prediction for experiment. So we're still looking, actually, for experiments where people really measure this Barkhausen noise at different disorders and do exactly the same procedure. On the one hand, to test this, there's some tests for the exponents, and that I'll show you. But also, if they do the same procedure, they should get the exact same scaling function. And this has a lot more information than just the exponent. So this entire function here is universal. So this is a prediction for experiments. And if someone would do this experiment and find this, then it would be really a very strong indication that this theory is correct. Now, talking about a phase transition, here's the phase diagram. On one axis, you have the disorder. On the other, the magnetic field. So if you raise the field at high disorder, you get smooth loops. At low disorder, you eventually hit a point with an infinite avalanche. That would be this line here. And in between these two regimes, you have a critical point where you find scaling and universal behavior. Now, what makes this so interesting is in equilibrium phase transitions, typically, you have to tune your temperature very carefully to see universal scaling. So if you go 2% away from TC, usually you lose the scaling. But in this case, the critical region is enormously large. So if you look at this, if you go 50% away from the critical disorder, you still have 2 decades of power law scaling. And we think this is why this could be important for real systems. You may just, with your samples, a lot of these systems show power law scaling for various reasons. But in some of these, it may just be that you, because the scaling region is so huge, you just are falling within this region, and that's why you see power law scaling. And then basically what we're saying, in order to test this, what needs to be done is this order needs to be changed, in an experiment. That would be great. And then one could test whether changing the disorder changes the cutoff in the size distribution. And then that would be an indication that really you are near such a phase transition that is where disorder is a tuning parameter. Okay. Now, I told you that you find the scaling, your scaling collapse, and all of this so far was numerical. But if you really want to understand why there is a phase transition or what's really going on, then I think the best approach would be to do a randomization group study. And the idea here is if you have a system with power law scaling, then in this case, power law scaling near the phase transition tells you that the system looks the same on different scales because power laws are these functions that look the same on different scales. So you might think, well, does the system, when I look at it, look the same no matter on which scale I look at it? So here we have a cut through a system of 100 cubed spins. The different colors show different avalanches that happen as you swept the field from minus infinity to plus infinity. And you see that you get, this is now taken near the critical disorder, and you see you get big avalanches and tiny ones. Basically, you see a whole range of avalanche sizes, just like you would expect for a system that has a power law distribution of avalanche sizes. So you get avalanches of all sizes. Now, here is a system of 1,000 cube spins, rescaled, also at the critical point. And you see also avalanches of all sizes, and especially that sort of if you blur your eyes, these two look statistically speaking the same. And that just tells you the system is indeed self-similar on different scales. And the randomization group procedure uses this feature. Basically what it is you take a system and you coarse grain it to different length scales, and phase transition points are then fixed points under this coarse graining transformation, because at phase transitions the system looks the same no matter on which scale you look at it. And so then you can look for these fixed points and then linearize around them and calculate these critical exponents. Now I won't go through this, but we did this the nice thing is you can, okay, I'll just give you a hint of an idea how to do it, and if you're interested I can tell you more later. But the main idea was when you were going to do this for the system is if you have a system with a configuration of spins and you raise your field, then your system follows a given path. So every time you raise the field for this particular configuration of spins, the system follows the same path because it's a deterministic system at zero temperature. If you take a different configuration of random fields and you raise the field, then your system follows a different path, like this red path here. Now, what you do, the whole idea of the calculation is you give a delta function weight to the correct path for a given configuration of random fields. And then you average over the disorder. So you look at all ensembles of all the different possible realizations of your disorder. You average over those, and then you end up with a probability distribution of the different paths that your system can take as you raise the field. Now, this probability distribution of the different paths is the analog of the probability distribution of different states that you have in equilibrium systems. And so basically, you can then write a partition function where instead of you having a sum over different states, you just have a path integral over different paths that your system can take. And then you can use all these methods that are used, developed for equilibrium phase transitions. And I will not, bore you with the details. But we do a momentum shell randomization group. But the main point is that what you find in the end is that 6 is the upper critical dimension for the system. What that means is above 6 dimensions, for crystals with more than 6 dimensions, the scaling exponents that you find are the same as in mean field theory. Mean field theory is the theory where every spin is coupled to every other spin in the system. And in order to get down to 3 or 2 dimensions where you have experiments, you really have to do an expansion around 6 dimensions. So this is the 6 minus epsilon expansion, where epsilon is the distance, how far you are in dimension from 6 dimensions. And here are the results. So on this axis is plotted the exponent value, and on this axis the dimension. At 6 dimensions, you have mean field exponents, which you can get exactly. And then you do this 6 minus epsilon expansion, which is actually an asymptotic series, so it has radius of convergence 0. But if we look at it, it still works surprisingly well down to 3 dimensions. So basically, what you're looking at here is different exponents. So tau plus sigma beta delta, remember that was the avalanche size distribution exponent. And the dashed lines are the results from the analytic expansion. And the dots with arrow bars in various dimensions are the results from simulations in various dimensions. And then you see they agree as you go down towards 3 dimensions. Now, this is not so interesting, I think, for what I want to talk about. This is more this got us more excited. Now, I'll come back to why we did the epsilon expansion. We'll get to that in a moment. But this is a comparison to experiments. So here is, again, the exponent value on the y-axis. And on the x-axis are different, basically, forget, this is not really an axis. This is just plotted next to each other, just different exponents. So for the size distribution and the distribution of the duration of the avalanches, and then the power spectra, scaling exponents, and so on, whatever we could find in the literature. And the squares are exponents that were measured in Barkhausen noise experiments. Now remember, I was saying there is no experiment so far where people changed the disorder and measured the Barkhausen noise, as far as I know. But there were a lot of publications in the literature where people had just taken one sample, and they found power law scaling, they fitted a power law to it, and then they basically recorded what that was. And so these squares here are those different values for power law exponents for Barkhausen noise that we found in the literature. And you notice, basically, and then the red dots are the predictions in three dimensions from our model, from this model. And you notice, for all of these different quantities, the range here is from 1 to 3, so we were happy. We're not off by a factor 10. I mean, we fall within the range of the experiments for these exponents. So we got excited, until we noticed we were not the only ones, because there's another model, which is the front propagation model, which is the model where you don't allow avalanches to happen anywhere in the bulk, but you only allow avalanches to happen at an interface. You know, you could, basically what I'm trying to say is, in our model, when we raise the field, basically what happens is you trigger avalanches anywhere in the bulk. But there was a competing model, which is correct for some systems, where you don't allow spins to flip anywhere in the bulk, but basically what you say is you have an interface between spins, one direction spins the other direction, and as you raise the field, you only allow avalanches to happen at the interface. So it's a different dynamics, and it's a different universality class. And that's these black triangles. And they, comparing to this huge range of experimental values, they do pretty much just as good a job. Correct. There are three. There should be three independent, because you have Z, and then you have and these are, by the way, these are only avalanche exponents. So you have nu, and then you have sigma. But you're absolutely right. These are combinations of exponents. That's correct. So they're not all independent, but we just took them from the literature as they were, and it's just compared. Yes, you're absolutely right. Well, we have actually. Let me show you. When we got this, we said, okay, these front propagation. You know, basically, we need a better way than just comparing exponents to compare to simulations. And remember, I showed you early on that there was a scaling function, right? This one, I said this entire function is universal. And this has a whole lot more information than just a set of exponents, of a handful of exponents. So we were saying, okay, it would be nice if we could compare this function, but nobody can do or has done the experiments of different disorders yet, so we couldn't compare that. But there's one scaling function that is you can get from the data that's available so far. And that is the scaling function. And this one actually, try to get this point, because this will link to the earthquakes later. So this is one of the connections. When you have an avalanche in these magnets, I told you earlier, you plot the voltage that you measure in a loop as a function of time. So this is plotted here, and you get a very noisy signal. So even if you blow up a single avalanche itself looks very noisy also. So it means even while an avalanche propagates, sometimes it goes fast, and then it sort of goes very slow, and then it goes faster again. So it's a very jerky process for this propagation of these avalanches. So the signal looks very noisy, much noisier even than this hand-drawn sketch here. But you can show that if you take all avalanches, okay, if you sit at the critical point where you have scaling in your avalanche size distribution, then you can show if you take all the avalanches of a given size and you average their signals, you know, average the voltage signal, then you get this mean profile of an avalanche. And this mean profile as a function of time tells you basically how many spins you have flipping per time on average as these avalanches propagate. So it starts with from zero, goes back to zero when the avalanche ends. And if you do that, so this profile that you get then by averaging is universal. Basically what I'm trying to say is if you do the same thing for avalanches of a longer duration and you average, you get just a rescaled version of the profile. And again, you can stretch these axes so that you collapse all these profiles of different avalanche durations onto one curve, and this is a universal prediction for experiment. The nice thing for this scaling function is you don't need to change this order to get it. So you can, all you need is one data set for some Barkhausen noise that has scaling, and then you can extract it from that. And Amit Mehta, who was a student in our group, he did that, and he found basically he did it for both the nucleation model and for the front propagation model, and he found basically profiles here. If you put them on top of each other, you can't tell the difference. They look very similar, even though the exponents are different for the two models. But what I want you to notice is that this is a very symmetric profile. In fact, in mean field theory, it's just a parabola. So we were really happy because now we finally had a scaling function, and then we went downstairs to Mike Weissman's group, and they do these experiments on Barkhausen noise and said, look, we finally got the thing that can show that we're right, and could you measure this? And they measured it, and this is what they got. So actually, Mike Weissman's data is this one here, and Andrea Mills, they measured this one. And these two other ones are from other experimental groups, Gianfranco Durin in Italy and Spasojevic also in Europe. And all three of these experiments showed, first of all, that they didn't agree with each other, and second, that they all had this asymmetry. So the avalanches basically increased faster than they were dying off. And in the model, definitely you don't have this asymmetry. And for a long time, there was a question, why is this? Why do all the exponents at least agree, error bars, but this is definitely different? And why don't the experiments agree with each other? And then Stefano Zapperi and Gianfranco Durin came, and their collaborators came with this very nice idea. They said it could be eddy currents. And this, again, will link to the earthquake, so I want to emphasize this point. Eddy currents. What are eddy currents? If you have a spin that flips, you will induce a little current loop in your if you have a conducting magnet that will try to oppose the flux change just by induction, right? So basically, if you have a spin flip, then you will have these little eddy currents that for a moment prevent other spins that usually would be triggered. For a moment, they keep them still down. They prevent them from flipping. But because you have resistance in your magnet, these eddy currents will die down. And when they die down, there's no reason anymore for an unstable spin to flip. And so then the neighbors will flip. So basically what these eddy currents do is they introduce a small delay effect. And this delay time is a microscopic quantity. It depends on the resistivity of your material. So it varies from material to material. So in some systems, it will be longer compared to the avalanche duration than in other systems. So then basically what they did is they put it into a model and they showed that the effect of such a delay is to make this function asymmetric in this way, in this direction, tilted to the left. And then basically what they also did is they looked at avalanches of longer and longer durations, and you would expect if these eddy currents are really only a microscopic effect, then if you take avalanches which are long compared to this tiny eddy current lifetime, then the effect should get less and less, right? So in the infinite system limit, it should go back to the symmetric prediction from our model that doesn't have eddy currents. Because for very long avalanches, this short delay time is negligible. And they found that indeed, as they looked at these profiles for very long avalanches, they found less of an asymmetry than when they looked at these profiles for shorter avalanches. So this is really just this asymmetry is just a microscopic effect which is non-universal. The strength of the asymmetry depends on the scale of the avalanches that you're looking at and the resistivity of the material and so on. Yes, that's exactly what I asked Mike Weissman, and they can't do it right now. They don't have the samples, but there's another group that's looking into it right now. So we don't have the data yet, but that would be exactly the test. Exactly, right. So we don't know yet, but the data they had looked very promising on this part. Okay, so basically the message here is delay effects give you this asymmetry in this direction, but really on long length scales it should go back to the model predictions. All right. So now I've talked about this phase transition as a function of disorder. Now you might ask, all right, you've done it for the magnets. That's fine, but how interesting is this for other systems? So the question is, how big is the universality class of this system? And it turns out it's huge. It's much bigger than we expected. So for example, you can start with, instead of having, if you would replace the random couplings here, if you would say, I change the disorder in the system and I introduce random couplings, still positive, but random positive mean, but random couplings. Would that change the universality class for this phase transition? The answer is no. You can show, that was actually, to be honest, that was the motivation for doing the rumorization group study. The rumorization group allows you to make all kinds of changes to this model and then coarse grain it and look if you, under coarse graining, all these different models still end up at the same fixed point. And if they do, you know, you can basically assess how big is your universality class. And so we did that, and we found, okay, random bonds are in the same universality class. Also, even by your symmetry arguments, you can already argue that random anisotropies, as you have in magnets, are also going to be in the same universality class. The reason being that your external field already breaks all these symmetries of having things pointing in all directions. And so the external field also already gives you a preferred direction, and it breaks the time reversal symmetry. So it's very different from the equilibrium version of this model, where every time you do these changes, you end up in a different universality class. In the non-equilibrium version, changing the disorder seems to get you always in the same universality class. Also, I didn't mention this, but you know, if you change the distribution of random fields, of course, you can show from the memorization group calculation, you know, if you would use a parabola or something, it's all the same exponent. So basically, little changes like that to the model don't change your universality class. But even more so, you can show with the same tools that a model for plastic charge density wave depending, for example, also ends up in the same universality class. Then earthquakes, I'll say something about that. The mean field is the same as the exponents are the mean field exponents of this. Then we've also looked at superconductors. There is also a certain model you can look at which ends up in the same universality class for stripes and superconductors. So basically, there's a whole bunch of different models that, under coarse grinding, end up in this universality class. And I think the reason is what they all have in common is they have this competition between the coupling and the disorder, and that leads to these avalanches of all sizes. Now you could ask, okay, what do I have to do to finally get into a different universality class out of this? And the answer for that is you could add long-range forces. So for example, in the magnets, really what you have is you don't just have nearest neighbor coupling, but you have dipolar forces also, which are long-range. And they actually put you into the universality class of interface depinning. When you add them, you don't have these avalanches happening anywhere in the bulk anymore, but preferentially they happen at the interface and you get this interface depending universality class. So they change the universality class. Now what I'm going to do is for just maybe 3 minutes at most or so, I just want to flash up a few other things that are also in the same universality class. So the same, the reason I'm doing this is because this model is very much non-equilibrium physics. And I think there are sort of new things you can look at that weren't that are totally different from equilibrium physics. And so that's why we thought it was kind of neat to look at them in more detail. So for example, you could ask, so far we've only looked at saturation curve, the saturation hysteresis loop. But You can also say, instead of always going through the saturation hysteresis loop from everybody down to everybody up, I can go through subloops. The way you do that is you don't drive your system all the way, you don't increase your field all the way up to plus infinity, but you reduce it, you sweep your field up, and then you reverse the field direction before you hit saturation. And so basically this picture here was produced by ringing down the field, like people do when they demagnetize a system. And then when you do that, you end up with these concentric subloops. Now, we did this here at the critical disorder. And you notice, while the saturation loop is critical, it has scaling, it has basically very flat parts and very steep parts, which correspond to avalanches of all sizes. When you look at the innermost subloop here, that looks very flat. That reminds you probably in its shape much more of hysteresis loops at high disorder. So we took, actually, John Carpenter, who was a student in our group, he took that literal, and he basically just used the return point for getting these subloops as a tuning parameter. So instead of tuning this order, he's tuning the history of the system in a way, if you like. And he found, and then he looked at basically avalanche size distributions of subloops, and then he found, yeah, that indeed, he's basically, when the saturation loop has diverging correlation length, then as he tunes this return point, he's tuning away from the critical point, and he could collapse the avalanche size distributions for these different subloops. And he found, actually, just like for the saturation loop, he found the same critical points, so the same exponents, everything the same. Then we thought, great, we're going to do... So one comment. So basically what he found especially was that the cutoff in the avalanche size distribution, this is actually the correlation function, that's why it looks a little different. But if but again, also for the avalanche size distribution, he finds that as he tunes inward to the subloop, the cutoff of the distribution changes, like you would expect. And so we got all excited because we thought, great, now we don't have to ask the experimentalists to change the disorder. Because they can tune history easily. They don't have to change the sample. So we thought, now we finally can see if you get that same scaling function that we had before just by taking one sample that has scaling and then tuning the history inside. So we went again to Mike Weissman. And, first of all, Andreas Berger, actually, who at the time was in Hitachi, now he's in Spain, he had some samples for disk materials where he could do the same. The outer loop looked critical, and he was tuning inside, and it looked pretty... This is a simulation, this is in his experiment. And qualitatively, we could see this was going in the right direction. Problem was, he could not measure the Barkhausen noise. He just didn't have the setup at Hitachi for that. So we couldn't really get the data that we wanted. But Mike Weissman is an expert on Barkhausen noise, so we asked him to do this. So he had a soft magnet, and we said, if you tune in, you will definitely see a change in the cutoff in your avalanche size distribution. And we were so sure of this. And he measured it, and he saw nothing. He always, as he tuned in, you know, he cycled inside, like here's the loop, and he was cycling in. There was no change in cutoff at all. Until we realized, of course, he was using a soft magnet. Soft magnets have strong dipolar forces. And dipolar forces lead to interface propagation dynamics. So basically, with soft magnets, as you tune your field, all you do is you move your domain wall back and forth. So you always get, every time you move the domain wall, you get the same avalanche statistics. So no wonder that as he tuned in, he always got the same avalanche size distribution. The only system where you would see a change in the cutoff would be a system where you don't have these long-range forces and where you don't have interface-depending dynamics, but where you have avalanches happening all over the bulk. And the reason is that as you tune in, you know, these avalanches that happened before, they will leave behind some frozen in clusters that will act as an added disorder, and that's why you see this change in the shape of the loop. So right now, there is no... They don't have the samples yet, so there's no measurement yet to do this for those systems. But this would be a nice way to determine whether long-range forces in your system are important or not. You could just do this test, and if you always get the same response for as you ring down your field, then you probably have interface dynamics. And if you see a change in cutoff, it tells you that you have something else going on with clusters left behind. So So that would be the prediction. So basically, the message from this part was ringing down the field gives you the same, at least in the prediction, gives you the same exponents, and we're still waiting for experiments. another thing you can do is you can look at the demagnetization curve. So if you ring down your field until you demagnetize your system, you get to this point. And if you then raise the field all the way up back to infinity, you follow the demagnetization curve. And so what John Carpenter did is he measured this demagnetization curve for different disorders, and he found, again, here's the avalanche size distribution for the demagnetization curve for different disorders. He collapsed them, and he got exact same collapse as for the saturation loop and the same function again. So demagnetization curve is also in the same universality class. And now it gets interesting. So we have the subloops and the demagnetization curve. And now comes the work of Yang Liu. For a long time, people have wondered, there's a lot of very nice work on the equilibrium phase transition of this model. So I've talked so far about the non-equilibrium transition where you go from hysteresis loops with a jump to those without a jump. But long before we even thought about this, there had been a lot of very nice work on the equilibrium phase transition of the random field easing model. And so basically equilibrium means thermal equilibrium. At zero temperature, it means that you are actually in the ground state of your system. So just so you understand, we are in non-equilibrium, so that means if you look at the energy landscape, we'll sit in some metastable state typically. As we change the field, basically what the system does is, in this energy landscape, it sort of follows a valley follows a sequence of metastable states. But you can also ask, what about the ground state of the system, which would be the state with the lowest energy at zero temperature? And that state, as you raise the field, has no hysteresis. So basically, at very lowest order, you have a ferromagnetic phase. So if you increase your field at low disorder in the equilibrium, eventually you hit a point where everybody flips at zero field. You have basically this jump from negative magnetization to positive magnetization. That would be for very low disorder. And for high disorder, you're in a paramagnetic phase, if you like. And there, as you raise the field, you have a smooth change that goes through a point at zero magnetization at zero field. So basically, there is this equilibrium phase transition that has no hysteresis. Now, for a while, people had wondered whether the equilibrium state and the demagnetized state are similar. So experimentalists often use demagnetization as a way to get close to equilibrium to the equilibrium state. And the question was, people knew that that the two states were not the same. So the state that you get by ringing down the field and the state that you get by equilibrating the system, they're not the same. But you can still ask, do they scale in the same way? Do they have the same scaling exponents? And Stefano Zapperi and collaborators, they answered that question. They did simulations of calculating the exponents of the ground state and the demagnetized state, and they saw that they were within error bars. Also, what we knew long ago was that for the saturation critical point, the one that I just talked about for the last half hour, and the equilibrium state, they both have also overlapping error bars in three dimensions, four dimensions. If you look at the simulations, you can't tell the difference. In fact, over here I'm showing you the red dots are exponents for the saturation loop, and the green ones are from different papers by different authors for the equilibrium critical point, and you see that they are all within error bars. So there was this question out there, could they actually be the same? But physically speaking, we never thought there was a reason for them to be the same, because you're in completely different states. Why should they be the same? But another thing that happened was the 6 minus epsilon expansion that we had for the saturation state and the 6 minus epsilon expansion for the equilibrium state, which actually is very much controversial, the one for the equilibrium. But anyways, if you at face value, they're the same to all orders in epsilon. So there was also a surprise. So we weren't quite sure what to do, what to make of this. And there's some symmetries that are the same. They both have this no passing rule, which is that's the thing. And then we just had this stuff from Carpenter, John Carpenter. He found that the demagnetization curve and the saturation loop are in the same critical point. So it all sounds numerically like as if it is the same. And then Yang said, well, this is just comparing exponents. Why not look at scaling functions? So he did a very careful study of avalanches of the equilibrium curve. So basically, as if you the equilibrium curve also, if you calculate the equilibrium state very carefully as a function of h, you can this develops in steps. So if you blow this up, this is not smooth, but it's just as jerky as the saturation loop. And then he did histograms of the equilibrium curve and compared them. So here is again histograms of the avalanche size distribution for the equilibrium system at different disorders. And again, he found that the critical point jumps off all sizes, and he tunes as he changes to this disorder, the cutoff changes. And he rescales these axes, and he gets this exact scaling function with the same exponents as the non-equilibrium. And actually, we've overlaid on here the function from the non-equilibrium, and it seems to be the exact same function, too. And having the same function, we thought, now that's very suspicious. So if you actually have the same function, then you really might... This is a much stronger indication, we think, than just comparing this set of exponents. So we think that equilibrium is also in the semi-Rosati class. And then he did a lot of other stuff. He looked at fractal properties of these avalanches and so on. And he looked at all these different fractal exponents and isotropies and so on. And all of this seemed consistent, so he think that... So we think they really seem to belong to the same Rosati class. Because also for these other quantities, we also got the same functions. He has much cleaner data now, but this, whatever we do, it looks the same. Maybe we should check the code. I don't know. but anyway, so the result is I told you about this phase transition from hysteresis loops with a jump to those without a jump, and I said. All right, you have a critical disorder where you have avalanches of all sizes, and for clean systems, you get these big runaway events. So basically, this is the histogram of the avalanche sizes for different disorders. And there's a lot more that I didn't say about. You can compare second spectra, which seems to work, and so on, and temperature effects. But anyways, I gave a talk on this, and I showed this picture here, where you see a change in the statistics of your avalanches as a function of disorder. From having big runaway events, much bigger than the small events for clean systems, to having a power law at higher disorder or near the critical disorder. And there was a geophysicist in the audience, Yehuda Ben-Zion, who is now at the SCEC, at the Southern California Earthquake Center. And he saw this, and he afterwards came to me and he said, this looks exactly like earthquakes. And then he showed me this data. So here, this is statistics of earthquakes. For different earthquake faults. So on this axis is plotted how often do an earthquake get an earthquake as a function of its size. So the Guttenberg-Richter magnitude is really 2/3 of the log of the total displacement. So it's really a log-log plot that you see here. If you take the total displacement, which is the integrated slip in an earthquake, as a measure of its size, that's really the analog of our avalanche size and the magnet. And turns out you find for a lot of earthquake zones, you find a Guttenberg-Richter scaling. That means you have basically power law scaling over a broad range with a Guttenberg-Richter exponent. Now, it turns out though you don't always find this. In some earthquake faults, you find what's called characteristic earthquake distribution, which looks like this. So an example would be the San Andreas fault. It has, you know, which has whatever every 50 years or so the big rupture, and in between small events, or here's a different fault actually that has it also. While other faults, the San Jacinto fault, for example, has this broad Guttenberg-Richter distribution. And the question in geophysics was, first of all, why do you get power law scaling, and then why don't you always get power law scaling? And now it turns out if you look at the shape of these faults for these different statistics, you find something very interesting. So Steve Wisnotsky did this. He looked at the shape and could find a correlation between the shape of the faults and the statistics. So he found that those faults that give you Guttenberg-Richter scaling tend to be the faults that are young, they have a lot of offsets when you look at them. They're very crooked in their shape still. While the faults that give you this characteristic earthquake distribution tend to be the older faults, which have been smoothed out a lot over the years. So if you look at the San Andreas fault, it's pretty straight over huge stretches. So those, the geometrically cleaner faults, if you like, give you this behavior, while the more disordered ones give you this. So then what we did is, I guess I talked too much. We looked at a model that was developed in geophysics, which is basically so Yehuda Ben Zion and Jim Rice came up with this idea of projecting a three-dimensional fault onto two dimensions, where and then taking these offsets in the fault into account as geometrical. These geometrical irregularities, they take them into account as basically disordered brittle properties. So basically what they say is they're patches that are harder to break than others across the fault, to somehow effectively model these offsets in this three-dimensional structure. And so since I'm afraid I'm running out of time, I'll spare you the details on the model. I'm happy to tell you, but I just want to give you the main idea. So we took this model, which is now really just loading all these patches on here and then treating them as little dislocations that get pulled by the drift far away. And then if one cell fails, it jumps forward and it can trigger other cells to fail also. And one difference to the magnets is that if you now project the bulk material onto these two dimensions, you end up with effectively long-range elastic interactions along the fault. And they're actually so long-range that mean field theory, which couples every patch to every other patch, is correct in the physical dimension. So we can now actually calculate the avalanche size distribution for this model in mean field theory and know that the exponents we get should be applied to the physical dimension, which is perfect. So we don't have to simulate. And so we treated this model with the same tools, the normalization group, and so on, and found a phase diagram that looks just like in the magnets. So in this model, there is a parameter, which is the weakening parameter, which is actually something that is supposed to model the amount of disorder in the system, and effectively speaking. And then we find that for effectively clean systems, you get characteristic earthquake distribution for your event statistics, and for more disordered ones, you end up with Gutenberg-Richter statistics. And the power law is within these huge error bars that you have for earthquake statistics, but a lot of other models are too. So we're not claiming that this model is the model for earthquakes, but basically we were surprised that the role that disorder plays in the model seems to be reflected in the statistics of these measurements. Now, there's some very, very nice other approaches to earthquake statistics that are done here. Gene Carlson and Jim Langer did some really nice work, which highlights other aspects. So I'm not saying this is the final answer at all. This is just a very, very simple model, and I'll say what else needs to be done. So we find the same phase diagram with the same tools. But then we were saying, okay, we just learned that in earthquakes, you don't have much statistics. So all these scaling exponents have huge error bars, and to rule out any model is very difficult often because of the large error bars. So it would be much better, rather than just having exponents, it would be much nicer if you had scaling functions again, because they have more information. So we thought, well, there's one scaling function that seemed to work for the magnets. Why not use the same idea for the earthquakes? So that scaling function would be the analog of this mean avalanche shape function that I talked about for the magnets. The analog of that in the earthquakes would be the moment rate that you have as a function of time during an earthquake. So it's basically a function that tells you how much slip do you have per time as an earthquake progresses. Right? So that would be the analog of the question, how many spins flip per time during an avalanche in the magnets? And so we can calculate that function, again, because it's a universal function, we can just calculate the mean field function of that, because we found out mean field theory gives you the correct universal predictions in two dimensions, in the physical dimension. For three dimensions, I mean. So we calculated this function. So here's the moment rate, that's the amount of moment change per time as a function of time, and we found this parabola in mean field theory. It's the same parabola as we had for the magnet model in mean field theory. And then Yehuda Benzai, Susan Bielek, who's a seismologist, she had some data on moment rates for earthquakes, which is very noisy, unfortunately. And so basically she did the same thing. She took earthquakes of, Amit Mehta did that. He got the data from her, and then he basically averaged all earthquakes of the same duration and calculated the corresponding function for the earthquakes. And you notice you get an asymmetric shape tilted to the left, just like in the magnets. This is a different function. This is again the prediction, and this is the data, which is basically not averaging over fixed earthquakes of fixed time, but fixed moment. So that wasn't quite as interesting because it doesn't have this definite difference between theory and experiment that you have here or measurement. But basically, what we want to point out, you get the same asymmetry, and we think the reason for this asymmetry in the earthquakes may be similar. We're looking into this right now in more detail, but maybe similar to the effect of the eddy currents in magnets. Magnets, as I told you, the eddy currents lead to a delay effect. They delay the next shell of spins from flipping. In earthquakes, you also have a delay. When you change the stress, you don't get immediate response and immediate failure, but there is sort of a time it takes to nucleate the next earthquake. So there are similar delay effects, and we think those may be the reason for this asymmetry. And actually, one way you know about this asymmetry already is from the earthquakes, on the aftershocks. On a large scale, we know there are aftershocks, so you tend to have a big, you tend to have a big earthquake, and then usually you get aftershocks. So if you look at that, that already on a much larger scale reflects the same asymmetry. And if you would have eddy currents that would live much longer than they do in the magnets, you would probably also get aftershocks there, but they just don't live long enough. So I think these delay effects are the reason for this asymmetry. So here's the conclusion. We talked about magnets and earthquakes. You get the same phase diagram and everything, and here's some more stuff that needs to be done. Thank you very much. Yeah, good question. In the earthquakes, the long-range forces would be ferromagnetic or ferroelastic, if you like, in the way they act. So if a patch slips, the long-range forces will trigger another patch over here to slip in the same direction. In the magnets, the long-range forces are anti-ferromagnetic because they're dipolar forces. So if something flips up here, it flips down over here. So that's why they're different. Yeah, good question. Sure. Good. Very good point. Actually, what we think is, and this is what we're just about to test from some data, but it's known from some, there's some papers out that show some data that indicates this, that actually in a lot of earthquakes you trigger aftershocks before the main shock actually finishes. So that actually in the signal could very well be buried more than one event. So that actually it is a delay for triggering the new. So basically what I'm saying is while the main shock is still propagating, it already triggers an aftershock. And then in the signal, in the seismic signal, here, there's you just measure the seismic waves, and they didn't pull out the aftershocks that happen during the main shock. So one reason for this asymmetry could be that there are some aftershocks already buried in here. But we're going to test this from real data if that's true. That's just a hypothesis. Yeah, hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, good question. Actually, it turns out the answer is no. So basically, if you take a Heisenberg model, in fact, Rava Silver and Maron Carter, they did a study on this. They studied the ON model with the same tools, randomization group and so on, and then they had random fields pointing in all directions, not just up or down. And they found the exact same phase transition point. And the reason is this: when you apply a magnetic field in equilibrium, the critical point is at zero magnetic field. But in the non-equilibrium model, the scaling happens at non-zero field. So you have this Pavlov scaling when you already have a field that already breaks the rotational symmetry. So that's why even when you allow for spins pointing in all directions, effectively, you have the same symmetries as an Ising. Yeah, that's also where random anisotropies, in the semi-anisotropy class.